Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby, and today we're joined by Aaron Opaluski. Aaron is a true entrepreneur. He co-founded his first staffing company at just 24. He's now the CEO and founder of Spark Talent, a company he launched in 2013 at the age of 29. Since then, the business has grown to a portfolio of 7 staffing companies in diverse industries. 3 of the staffing companies he built consistently generate 8-figure revenues, and one of them, Spark Packaging, achieved 7 figures in its very first year. But Aaron's entrepreneurial spirit does not stop there. He's also a partner in 2 other companies outside of staffing, and he holds investments in food and beverage industry as well. Aaron, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Mark. It's awesome to be on.
Fantastic. So you were referred to me by Mike Williams. How do you know Mike?
So we met on LinkedIn, and we were chatting a little bit before on this before we started recording, but met on LinkedIn, just started following Mike's content and really liked what he had to say. And I can't remember. I think he sent me a message because we would like each other's posts and stuff like that. But we ended up on a phone call, and you know, we've done a couple phone calls. I love talking to other people in the industry that are building their businesses, and yeah, it's just a fun thing, right? Because we've organically built, you know, a couple. We've done some mergers, so you know, different aspects to it. But I'm watching what he's doing, and I'm like, man, like I really like what Mike's doing. As we talked to each other, and he was, I think the first time we talked, he was starting to bring people onto the team. And that's always a fun conversation for me, because there's like more complexities that come with that in the recruiting business. And I think he's a great guy, got a good head on his shoulders, and cheering for him.
100%. We're both cheering for him. He's an awesome guy. I really enjoyed that episode of the podcast. For listeners who want to check it out, it was about startup success, how to build $1,200,000 in your first 15 months. And so, yeah, that's cool. His content on LinkedIn is really good. And as is yours, actually, Aaron. So definitely encourage people to check out what you're doing on LinkedIn. Really good LinkedIn content there. So, yeah. So listen, how did you get into recruiting in the first place, Aaron?
Kind of fell into it like most people. I was doing personal training when I first got into recruiting. I was doing training with a director from Aerotech, and didn't know anything about recruiting. Didn't know that he was kind of recruiting me as we were doing some sessions together. But we got to know each other over a couple month period, and he asked me what I was looking to do kind of long term. And I told him, hey, you know, I want to be a CEO someday. I want to be in business. And of course, at the time, I had no clue what that meant. And, you know, he just one day came up to me. He's like, hey, would you like to interview with us? You know, I work at this company called Aerotech, and, you know, we do recruiting and staffing. And I knew nothing about what that really meant. But I had really started to look at him as a mentor and someone that I respected and looked up to. And I was interested and intrigued by that. So took an interview there, and was blessed with the opportunity to work there. Had a great experience for about 18 months there. Just learned a ton, and very grateful to everyone that mentored me while I was there.
Amazing. And then what was the journey of launching your very first staffing company at such an early age?
Well, the adversity of 2009, you know, so I got into recruiting in October of 2007.
Okay. Yep.
The industry, you know, people that had been in, and I think there's some lessons in this, but people that had been in would tell me that, like, oh, the industry was better before, like, you know, back when it was busy, you know, things like that. And I didn't know anything different. So I'm like, hey, like, we're making placements. I'm learning. My, you know, commission checks are growing. Like, I'm advancing with promotions. Like, you know, I don't know, but this is great. Like, I love it. And, you know, we got to 2009, and I was about 6 months into a promotion in sales at Aerotech, and they consolidated 4 offices in the state of Michigan as the auto industry was struggling. And about a month and a half after that consolidation, they laid off 80 or 90 people.
Wow. Which
our office was, I think it was about 80 people. And so of the 90, I think there was like 5 people left from our office by the time that was done. I was one of the people that was left, but I was demoted and I wasn't really fond of that.
And, yeah, no kidding.
You know, after, you know, I have a different perspective on it now, because I think the person that had that responsibility, which probably no one would want, had to go with who they knew. You know, when you're consolidating four offices, a couple hundred people, you just don't have the time in 45 days to probably evaluate that. There's a lot going on. I just look at it a lot differently now and kind of understand that they were in a tough spot there.
I mean, it sounds like as tough it was as it must have been at the time, it was a blessing in disguise, right? Because, you know, you've then gone on to bigger and better things and launched your own firm. So was that the, like, as soon as you went through that consolidation, like, what was the thought process then to say, do you know what? I'm going to make something, I'm going to build something of my own.
Yeah, it was shortly thereafter. I was still getting my degree at the time, and I loved what I was doing. You know, I looked at it like, man, I want to be at Aerotech forever. You know, like, going in there, I didn't have this like plan going on while I was there to go off and start my own business. But once that all kind of transpired in about a 90-day period or so, it was all of a month before we started, you know, our own firm. You know, I started with another person that was there. We did industrial staffing. My background at Aerotech was, I would do some of that on the side, but it was more engineering based.
Yep.
And so industrial staffing was a different pace. And I was used to it because I would do it at night while I worked at Aerotech, but it was like full bore, all kinds of high volume stuff right out of the gate. And it was definitely different than placing mechanical and electrical engineers.
Right. Okay, interesting. So, do you know what? I'd love to just dive into Spark Talent and learn how you've grown that over the last, you know, 10 plus years to, you know, a really successful portfolio of companies, because that's something that not many, you know, firm owners achieve, right? There's a lot of stuff to learn. There's a lot of complexity, there's a pain barrier to go through. And I'd love to just pick your brains and see how much we can glean in the time we have left. Does that sound right?
Sounds great.
All right. So what was the inspiration behind Spark Talent? Why, you know, did you, because you already had a firm that you were a partner in, why launch another one?
Yeah, well, you know, the first company, great experience, 50-50 partners, you know, I gave you that tight timeline of when we started. We started in a month. So guess what we didn't do? We didn't business plan,
right,
which is okay. We had agreements, but we didn't talk through those group agreements and delegate responsibilities and who's responsible for what. We didn't set core values. We didn't have a mission or vision that we really talked about. And that was, hey, there's some good things to that, because like, we were like, hey, let's go and let's get it done and let's produce results. And hey, you know, that worked well. We put together a great firm that was able to get up to eight figures in revenue in a 3-year period of time. You know, so we're doing some good things. But as we were growing and then adding to the team, not having some of those things figured out, I think it was kind of set up to fail as it hit certain levels. And, you know, there's more than one way to do things. Like, we had a different vision for how to move that forward. And so that business is still going, and we started Spark. And I think a big proponent for me was I wanted to promote people faster and expand back into some of these other markets, engineering, professional services, and even some of the things that have transpired now over a decade, right? Like, I wanted to do that. My other partner just didn't want to do those things the same way. And it just got to the point where it was best for us to be separate, you know? So that's what we did. That's how Spark started.
Awesome. And so what are some of the lessons you learned from the first business that you've applied to growing Spark Talent?
It was initially that if we were going to grow past certain points, we had to delegate responsibilities and give people opportunities to grow. And not that we didn't have any growth at the other firm, but we didn't promote a lot of people to give them the chance to own the account relationships and have responsibilities like that. So that's something that was wired into us from day one of Spark Talent. It's become our purpose as a company to help people grow. And you know, our first year, we grew 800% and promoted a bunch of people, probably too much, because we learned, you know, some things for that. And but that's just been wired into our DNA since day one.
Can we drill down on that a little bit deeper? So what's the, I love your purpose of helping people grow. Is that, did I say it right? Can you repeat what you said?
That's right. Yeah. It's okay. We help people grow. So you walk in our office, it's the first thing you see on the wall.
I love it. Okay. And by the way, if I've checked out the Spark website and it's really like, I like the images, the videos on there. You've got a lot about culture, about core values and that kind of stuff, which I'd love to get into. But let's first of all talk about what's the progression plan for people? Like, what's the career pathway for people at Spark and how have you designed that?
It's evolved over a decade, and I think I hope that it continues to evolve. You know, otherwise, you know, we're not necessarily, a core value of ours is be humble, crave improvement. Like, well, if it doesn't continue to evolve, I think that we're falling short, you know, for our team. So it started out with pretty normal career paths, like, hey, you can move into account management or like sales type roles. But it's now fragmented out to where we have career paths within recruiting, within account management, within business development, within some of our specialized teams, all the way up to, you know, high level, what we would call entrepreneurship, where you're running business units for us, to actual entrepreneurship, where as it stands right now in the 7 companies, we have 15 equity partners. Some of them operate the companies day to day, which is very important to that for us. Some of them sit on what we would call like our own little board of advisors for that company to help facilitate growth faster. Usually those are people that have been key parts of growing one of the other entities, and they might have a skill set or a good client crossover to introduce that other company or vertical.
I love this, Aaron. This is really cool. So like, the way that it's evolved and is stands currently, it sounds like the 3 primary functions are recruiting, account management, and business development. Is that right?
Yeah, but then also on our ops side, you know, in 2020, I really became kind of like a nerd for the ops side of the business. I kind of look at my progressions, you know, as a person, as a CEO, like that was an evolvement for me, because it went from like being good on the sales and production side. And it's not, I don't want to discount, it's not that I didn't know anything about the operational side, but I really drove down during that time period, which was adverse for us for a little bit. And then it wasn't, we really exploded from that again. But I drilled down on the operational side and learning the business and how we want to move stuff, and was able to look at some things that worked for us over a 6-7 year period. And, you know, when you're reading stuff that you kind of know, it hits you in a different way. Or when you learn, it's like, man, that's really right. So I don't know if I answered your question there, but like our ops sort team has completely evolved. Yeah. And we have tons of career paths out of that side too, that aren't just straight. They're not all salary. There's variable income to them.
Okay, that's really interesting, because a lot of the emphasis in recruiting, obviously it's a sales-oriented business, and it's the front office that really gets the glory and the promotion and the rewards. And then the back office, which of course is super important, especially in like temporary or contract staffing, the back office is even like more significant, but often they're sort of overshadowed. It sounds like you've tried to create opportunities for growth for everybody in the business, which fits in with your purpose, right? Helping people grow, which I think is tremendous. So we'll come around to the operations part in a second, because I think that is the Achilles heel of many entrepreneurs, especially recruiters and people who are sales oriented. And that is going to constrain people's growth if they don't really have a solid operational side of the business. So before we get into that though, like the model of the business, because you've mentioned these 3 kind of areas, is it a kind of split desk model where you have someone like focus on business development and then the account management manager and then the recruiter? Or what's the structure of the businesses?
So we have a mantra that we're all recruiters, and that, okay, you know, can mean different things at different levels, but we're all recruiters in some way, shape, or form. Right. And that goes for me too. I still interview everybody that walks through these doors and going to be part of our teams. Like, I look at myself as the number one recruiter, you know, within the businesses.
Yes.
And I'll also like, hey, I'll pick up a phone and get on with someone too. I don't do that as much anymore, but if I do it, I usually do it out in front of people, to be intentional about it.
We have a coaching program called Apex for entrepreneurs who want to scale. And one of the things that, you know, I'm constantly, you know, promoting is the idea that you as the owner need to be you need to own internal recruitment and get really good at recruiting for your own firm and
Absolutely.
Treat that with as much, like, that has to be just as high a priority as delivering for your clients. And, you know, somebody in your team, but probably the founder, needs to really be the owner of that. And doesn't mean that other leaders can't help to drive that forward and maybe even hire an internal recruiter for your own team. But is really the founder and the owner, usually, at least the size of companies we're talking about, not huge enterprises, internal recruiting. Like, there's really two things you need to get right. If you hire the right people and then you develop them and give them tremendous training, coaching, and support, it's almost inevitable that you'll be successful, right? And you can mess up a lot of other things, but if you get those two things right, then you're going to be in good shape. So I'm pleased to hear you talk about like how you really see yourself as the number one internal recruiter. So the original question, though, coming back to it, was what's the structure of the teams? You know, you mentioned different pathways for promotion, and I just was curious to know like what. How the business is set up.
Yep. So we have, thank you for, I can get off on a tangent.
So, no worries, me too.
So we have recruiters, we have account managers, we have business development, and then we have our internal ops team, an external ops team, and a group of that really services the portfolio of seven companies. So we have those. Our account managers, a big part of their job is still recruiting, you know, for their clients. That's a big part. Our only area that doesn't directly do a ton of recruiting, but we're trying to figure out how we even integrate this in. And we like doing it kind of like the front end relationship, like right now, but we're still tweaking this. Our business development people are more so involved in the upfront. And what we've liked, it's not always, but we're considering this, is like having them stay on and try and do the first placement or a placement. So they're learning, and that's helping them get better as they go back out to market and talk to other people. So we're still tinkering with that. And that's our newest area. Because at one point we just had salespeople that managed accounts and they did business development and they did some recruiting. And we felt like it was diluting the client experience and probably the candidate experience too. Yep. And we're obsessive around the lifetime value of clients. And
yes,
I think the industry in general, I think the more obsessed that we get around that, the more I feel like a lot of people look at it and be like, Aaron, you guys don't struggle in this area. But the more focused we get in that area, the more it keeps me up at night. I'm like, hey, we got to do better with this. Got to do better with this. And so that break off has been an evolvement of that for us, is like, hey, this is how we really focus in on giving the best experience to our clients. This is how we're going to know the most about them. So with that being new, we're trying to add back in more recruiting to that role too.
So it's funny, I've recorded two, this is the second podcast I recorded today. And on the last one, lifetime value of a customer came up as well. And it's like so weird because we've never talked about that, but then twice in one day, it's come up. And you're right, recruiters do not tend to focus on that. And, but what was interesting, you might find this interesting, Aaron. So the guy who I interviewed who mentioned this, His name is Manan. He is the founder and CEO of a recruiting software company called RecruiterFlow. And what he's observed from the data, because they have thousands of users, is that the companies that have the highest revenue per customer are also tend to be the bigger, more successful recruiting businesses. So it's like one of the things he's noticed is that the companies that get above a million in gross profit also have, you know, they also have a higher revenue per customer than the firms that are smaller. So how did you arrive at this lifetime value of a customer being important?
Well, I think it just keeps evolving, right? But so back in like in 2018, we had at that point, we had one company. It was just Spark Talent. Yep. We were actively billing probably anywhere from like 80 to 90 clients within a week at that point. Mm-hmm. And we were doing a lot of new business development too. Well, as we moved into 2019, we had collected, I think it was like over 100 new service agreements in 2018.
Wow.
And our active clients week to week weren't really going up. And that was my first like moment where I was like, man, I don't feel like we're doing a good, I feel like we need to do a better job on this. Now it's really increased from there. Like now I would look at that and just be like, I would have a pit in my stomach the way that was going on. But that was like, I was noticing that like something ain't right here. We're bringing in more stuff than we have actively billing. We're doing some good stuff. We got some amazing clients, but like there's stuff falling through, you know, too much is falling through. So in 2019, we kept that going and we saw kind of the same thing. We didn't really see a lot of growth with that. Well, then 2020 happens. And our active client base went down in March, as I'm sure a lot of people did.
100%, yeah.
And we looked at that, and it's like, okay, we have like, at the time, it was over 400 active agreements, and we're billing like 20% of that right now. Mm. We like, and we looked through some of the, like, hey, we were, you know, billing this, you know, doing this much business with this client, and right now we're doing nothing, like, why, you know, what's happened? And it's like, oh yeah, it's like, I could look at that and say, well, this salesperson didn't do this or that. Like, no, it's my fault. You know, it's my fault. Like, what do we got to do to fix that? And so we kind of shut down new business development and focused on more of like nurturing the client base. And we did that all the way from March of 2020 to the end of 2022. And it wasn't until 2023 that we turned back on that new business development lever. Well, when in the process of that, we took our active headcount up about 50% from its former.
Wow. Head. That's crazy. So
it's good. There's still much work to do because that means we still are not even at 50% of an active service agreement, you know, but it's improved quite a bit.
So you went from 20% to 50% of your act service agreements that you're actually billing with. Did I understand that correctly?
We went, I think our high's been right around 145 in a week. So, yeah. And that's held, we were able to break that three times last year with new business development. So it's one of the things we track.
Yeah.
But so I don't know what the I should know, but that's, 45 would be 130. Yeah, so we're above 50% growth on that from before we had kind of switched our mindset on that. But there's a lot of work to do still. We can do much better. So we're working on it every day.
Aaron, there's so many directions we could take this conversation, but I'm interested, like what did you do differently to nurture those clients?
I think it starts with looking at it like, hey, like, oh, like, I would never have told you this back then, but I think there was a little bit of a mindset of like, well, if something doesn't work out, we'll just find another client. And it like pains me to say that right now because I don't feel like that was ever directly said, but I think there was like some undertone like language or like just the way that we would like develop our teams, it was taught to hunt. Well, what about like maintaining great relationships? Not that we never talked about that, we did, but I don't think we were obsessive around it or on how important that is. Or like, hey, do a good job, do what you say you're going to do, like go above and beyond in the extra mile for the client. Like, so one of our own core values, find a way to deliver a value for your clients, right? Like, I don't feel like we were doing a good enough job of that, and we've got much better. And there, within that, there's just much room to improve still.
And Aaron, like, I think nobody would disagree with anything you've just said in terms of like the importance of client relationships and delivering value and so on. But what, in practical terms, what did you do to improve? Because having the philosophy is one thing, but actually implementing it is where a lot of recruiters get stuck. You know, they focus on the new business, the new, you know, because it's, and then, so what were some of the kind of practical changes?
Yeah, some of the tactical things that we did is instead of, you know, we really tried to take our account management role, and it's, there's still some nuance to this, but like instead of someone having 30 accounts, try and get them the right 10.
Mm.
We started to focus more in on niches. You know, we do both volume and non-volume recruiting. We do contract, we do direct hire. You know, we have 8 different service lines between the companies. We didn't when we started this process, but like there's a lot going on, and that's great. But if you're not disciplined, if you don't have a plan with that, it can really lead you in a bunch of different directions, and it just dilutes your value to the client. Mm-hmm. So we had to work through that because we were doing some of that and really had to get our roles dialed in on who was doing what, how we were going to focus them in. And as we put more of a focus on the type of role, the amounts of accounts for account managers, we started to improve that service and would get more active billing clients going at once within each of those account managers. And then we scaled that role. You know, when we started that role, we had some legacy people on our sales role, and it was June of 2021 when we put the first official, hey, they're just going to do account management, no sales development. Like that's their focus. At least no KPIs behind it. They could bring an account in, but there's no KPIs behind it for them. Mm-hmm. Well, by the time we got 2 years out on that, so midway through 2023, we had 20 people in that role, that new role. So we took it from 1 to 20 in that period of time. And that was a focal point. So there was that. And then it's definitely not, we put an emphasis on training. It's, I don't want this to come off like it's me doing it because it's a lot of great people. But I feel like I own a responsibility in that. And, you know, every 2 weeks I run an account management training with our account management teams from across all the companies. So there's other trainings that we have in place, but it's really like ongoing development. Like that's an important thing. Reminding people of things that they've learned that they need to maybe tweak.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And so there's a lot to unpack there. One thing I was curious about, Aaron, is what, because you mentioned contract and direct hire. What's the split or the mix there?
It's different company by company. We just introduced 2 of our portfolio companies to contract, the contract side of the business last year, and one in Q3 and one in Q4. We're actually running our new reports because we've added from August of last year, we've done 4 new businesses. So I'm worried like that we brought in. So I think we're,
wow. Okay.
We're done. Like, and that was my main recruiting part of recruiting for me is like M&A, you know, type stuff, right? Well, we're pretty heavy on that right now. So we're doing, I expect us to come in somewhere on our contract sales, be in about 50% of our overall gross profit. It's much higher on the revenue, right? I like that you said gross profit earlier because, you know, in staffing, revenue is one thing. Gross profit's really what's the most important to me. And at the same time, you want to make sure you have good reoccurrings, in my opinion, or that's a good thing to add to your business. So we get about half of our gross profit right now from contract, you know, style placements. And then we have another 25% or so that comes from different reoccurring styles outside of contract. And then the rest is direct placement, or, you know, we don't call it retained, we call it engaged search, but you know, upfront searches that we're taking.
I high five, Aaron, because I'm 100% with you on the gross profit thing. I don't know why so many staffing companies focus on revenue. It's because I mean, obviously, on one level, like, bigger is better as far as revenue. But on the other hand, like, gross profit is a more important metric as far as I'm concerned. And the reason I think, like, we always talk about gross profit is because we're trying to compare like for like with our permanent clients versus our temporary clients that do temporary. And the only way you can really compare them is, well, what's the GP, right? And because that's
correct.
And of course, everyone's heard the expression, you know, revenue is vanity, and then profit is sanity, and cash is reality. And, you know, GP, 100%. That's a more important thing to focus on as far as growing is concerned. So I'd love to learn more about how you've kind of built out the business, because you've mentioned acquisition, you've mentioned that you have different equity partners. And so there's an opportunity for people to even, you know, you've got intrapreneurship and then you've got entrepreneurship. Could you say more about how this has kind of evolved?
Absolutely. Well, it goes right back to the purpose. You know, our purpose is to help people grow. And we're in an industry that's very fragmented, right? Like, you get people that, you know, I want to build companies that I would want to be a part of. You know, that's a big thing for me. And I loved, you know, my time at Aerotech. And again, I had no plans of, like, going on and doing entrepreneurship. But at some point, like, they probably would have either kept elevating me there, or that may have happened, like whether I realized it at that point or not. So we don't have anything special within our companies that can't potentially happen to us too, where it's like, I believe that your vision for your company needs to be able to fit everyone else's visions inside of it. Mm-hmm. And so this is different for everybody. And I'm not suggesting, you know, I have coaches, you know, that I love, like, I look at as mentors and they're like, you're crazy having 15 equity partners, but I love it. And wouldn't have it any other way, because I think you get the chance to meet people where they're at, knowing that that can evolve and change for them over time. And without even getting to the technical side of, like, our EBITDA roll-up strategy or anything like that, it's just, you're providing a vehicle that no matter where someone's growth curve goes, like, they have that opportunity inside of our system, inside of our portfolio companies. And so that's a great recruiting tool, in my opinion. That's
absolutely
how we keep people and grow.
Exactly. You know, you've kind of solved, I've only come across one other guy in the podcast who has done something similar, and it's a British guy. Because if you think about it, one of the biggest, it feels like a tragedy when you have someone really, really good and they fit well within your culture, you like each other, there's a values alignment, but they reach a point where they want to run their own business, and that forces them to, you know, to split off from you and do their own thing in competition with you. Why? Surely it makes more sense for you to be an investor and back them and work together, but give them the opportunity to, you know, have ownership rather than compete with you.
That is my preference. And that doesn't mean that, you know, if someone's just like, oh, I want to be an equity partner, I'm out of here. Well, okay. Like, that's not probably a good setup for that.
Right.
But, you know, through our one-on-ones, through understanding what's important to people, how they want to grow, their goals and aspirations, like, we should be able to, like, we're recruiters, we're in workforce solutions. Like, we want to get really good at this stuff internally. Like, how do we help someone on these career paths? What does their career map look like? It can change over periods of time. It's not like we do it when they start and never talk to them about it again. Like, these are consistent things. And we want to understand what someone wants. And then, man, if I can paint a clear blueprint for them on how to get there, like what else? There's nothing else that I could want, you know. And hey, that doesn't mean that someone doesn't go off and do something else or whatever. But I believe we've set up the vehicle the best way possible to retain the right people within the culture, to help it grow, to, you know, there's so many niches and things you can do within recruiting, and we can't all be everything to everybody. And that's really what, where that's evolved for us, because talent doesn't have a niche. We operate in 10 different sectors and really 5 different swim lanes, and we still do that. But at one point, that was like 15 sectors, and it was even more swim lanes. And so as we've expanded, that's got tougher. And that's where we started to crack off and look for strategic mergers to kind of like, hey, like, we know this, but this group knows this better. Oh, and we can come in and give them 20 accounts like over a period of time. Like, we can really help this thing move. So that's what we've done in a couple of these instances.
Wow. So that's cool. Talk to me about the mergers and acquisitions part of this. Like, how have you identified those target companies that you think are going to be a good fit for you? Because there's probably other companies where you think, I wouldn't want to work with those guys, right? And so, you know, how do you find the companies that you think there's going to be mutual value and that they're going to fit within your, because you've built something pretty special and distinctive, and you want to preserve that, right? You don't want to dilute your culture. And that's the risk with M&A is, you know, it's these things don't gel together.
Yeah. Yeah. So we still haven't done an acquisition. We've done all mergers, or we've started them organically. Now, that doesn't mean we haven't looked at acquisitions. We've looked at where we've actually signed NDAs and looked through financials and stuff like that. It's more than I can count on two hands. We've looked at probably 100 different situations. We have a couple brokers that send us stuff to look at, but we've yet to do that. And that's one of the reasons. It's like, it just hasn't made sense for us yet, because we're not going to do something that pushes revenue up or pushes gross profit up $1 million or $3 million, even though that would be nice. Well, if it impacts what we have going on from a culture standpoint, it's not worth it. Let's just go pour into these other areas. So we haven't done an acquisition yet, but our biggest thing up to this point, in my opinion, has really been what we do on social. And it's not just about what we do on social. It's a mix of what we do on social and having an actual business that's growing and building a track record and doing something behind it. And that's how all our businesses have come together, whether it be organic, where we move someone. You know, we've taken people from one company and have them start something for us and just say, hey, we're doing this. Let's stack it over here so we can actually do it right and grow it and put an emphasis and focus on it. And like one of our most recents, she'll see this and probably laugh too, but I've been recruiting her for like 4 years and it just wasn't the right time. Yeah. And we are just starting the process. We had just added our first company. So I was actually recruiting her to try and come on at Talent. And she had just started something else and wanted to give that a fair shot and respected that, right? And just kind of backed off. But we've known each other for over a decade. We competed against each other at a high level, you know, for years. We started to get more friendly and like communicate on social during like that period and probably a little bit before it. And then we've kept in touch that way over a 3-year period. And, you know, the timing comes up right and we start to have more conversations. And next thing you know, we started that business in October and they're up rocking and rolling. They're already up over their headcount target for Q1 as it,
amazing,
you know, as we got into this week. So a lot has been through social.
Okay. Let's double click on that. Before we do, someone on this podcast has said, and I wish I could remember off the top of my head who it was, you know, they asked themselves, who are the best people we know and why aren't they already working here? Right. And it's that, you know, and it may not happen immediately, but if we know who is out there that we would love to partner with or work with, and we're just nurturing them, keeping in touch, kind of like you mentioned client nurturing, right? We should be doing the same thing for internal, like our future internal hires, and having that, you know, that prospect database that we're nurturing. So what does that look like on socials for you?
Well, for this is just my opinion. I don't know that this is actually right, but I think like, hey, by posting stuff on social, on how you go about situations, what you believe in, things that have worked or haven't worked for you, like you start to see if you have alignment with someone or not, right?
Yes.
And like, we're definitely not for everybody. Not everyone's going to agree with the way we do stuff, and that's completely fine. And there'll be people that do. Well, for the people that do, you're giving them a window into like how you think, how you operate. And I think you just get to some alignment, you know, quicker. I approach conversations now like even in that one, like I didn't have this master plan that in 4 years, this was going to come together. I stated my intentions that like, we would love to have her. It was in a different role, and I'm actually glad it didn't work out that way, because she wouldn't have been an owner. And I think that's really what she needed she was at that stage and she wanted to become an owner, and we weren't there yet on ripping out more of those companies this way. So the timing of that worked great. Well, as I'm approaching other combos, hey, if it goes that direction and we could provide value and there's a mutual value in a partnership, awesome. But like, it's also just fun to have the conversations. Like, the industry is not collaborative enough.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's not collaborative enough. And if you want to, you know, I believe you got to have an enemy. The enemy, you know, for me is the industry standard, how the industry standard operates, how they treat clients, how they treat each other. There's so many other industries that are way more collaborative than the recruiting industry. And there's no reason not to be. Like, I'm as competitive as you're going to find of a person, but that doesn't mean that there can't be other companies out there that do great things either. You know, yeah. And who am I going to get along with the most? Who am I going to like have meaningful conversations with? Who am I going to be able to just, whether it's financially a good thing for me or just like a impactful conversation? Well, it's people that are doing this, right? That
absolutely. Are it's
levels
so
of it before. So
yeah.
Some of my best friendships are now like people that we work with within the companies. And my favorite conversations are people just across the country and now even outside of the country with people that are in the industry that we can have good, meaningful conversations about how recruiting can be done, you know, compared to what's been standard for 30 plus years or however long it's been.
I love that mindset, Aaron. And you know, it's unbelievable when you share ideas with like-minded people. Well, number one, as you said, like you have so much in common with people who are in the same industry. So why wouldn't you just like share ideas, compare like best practices, and support each other, encourage each other, right? And so that's what we've tried to create in our community. We've got at this stage just over 60 like-minded recruiting firm owners who come together regularly to you know, cheer each other on and also share what's working for them. And you know, that's super interesting what people can learn from each other. How does so you haven't done acquisitions, but you've done mergers. What does that look like?
Yeah. So a couple of the businesses, without getting into like exact numbers, but like, so two of the mergers that we did were both under $1 million in gross profit. And we were able to quickly move those to over the $1 million line and going at the $3 million line within the first year. And that's because we were doing some of what they've done. I don't want to overgeneralize, but like, okay, we got good salespeople. We got good industry knowledge here on this, but they need some infrastructure support. They got to point the tip of the spear in the right direction, you know? So we could help them do that. Oh, by the way, it helps when we can over a period of time integrate in accounts in those situations and put them in front of more people to do business in an area that they're uniquely qualified to do it. Right. So that's worked well for us, you know, so far. And, you know, I've been grateful that we've been able to do a couple of those.
Fantastic. So you're looking for companies that with your infrastructure, your support, your know-how, they could like rapidly increase their GP basically.
Correct. And so we've done two under $1 million, and helped them both go over $1 million. Now, because we just did four in a shorter period of time, and one of those is EJ, who you met with a little bit today. It's more of a vertical integration for us. It's our media company for all the other companies. So we want to do things cool. The goal is to do things that if you come out within the portfolio, like immediately can improve the business, and we can do that at a way that's cost effective for those businesses too, through, you know, volume purchasing or, you know, blanket agreements, whatever it may be. Well, as we look at moving forward on that, it's not that we wouldn't do another one like that, but we're looking more now in that $3 million in gross profit range, you know, because, you know, you got certain issues at 1 million. It's my opinion, you go kind of 1 million in GP, then 3 million in GP, then 10 million in GP, and then 30 million in GP. And I can't tell you my thoughts anywhere past that at this point, because we're still learning. But like, there's different problems that you run into or different hurdles to jump at those levels.
Yeah.
So we know we can help at the 1 million. We know we can help at the 3 million level too, but we haven't done that in a merger yet, right out of the gate. We'd like to try and tackle that next, because we think you only got so much time. You know, so we think that would be the best one for us to tackle next with what we've built, you know, with the current seven.
That makes sense. I love it. Well, we're kind of going this direction anyway, so I want to circle back to the operations side of the business. You said a few years ago, you kind of had this realization that you needed to level up in that area, both personally and also as a business. Can you talk about what was the moment where that became obvious to you, that you, like, that was an area that was required, and then what did you do about it, and how has that evolved?
Yeah, I think my initial approach on this was very aggressive, and it helped us in a lot of ways, but I kind of had a number in mind, a net income number. I said, hey, let's cross this number. And everything else, if we get above that, cool. But like, let's grow this thing above that number. And that worked really well for us. You know, we started the company with 5 people, and we went to 20 in the first year. And then, like, as we made our way all the way up to about 50 people, that worked okay. And we moved that number along, like, year after year. Like, it worked okay. Well, what happened in 2019, like, just to be, you know, business for us has not gone like straight like that. We kind of have gone in some loops of growth. Well, we've always been fortunate enough to be, you know, profitable, you know, some years better than others, right? But we, like, as we look at some of these other businesses, it also gives you perspective on, like, okay, even in our bad years, like, our numbers were good still, but not up to our standard on how we want to move the businesses. And so in 19 for us, we had expanded internally, you know, quite a bit as we were pushing, and we're up over this net income number. Cool. Well, then what happens? We hit one of those loops, and we didn't hit one of those loops with 20 people on the team. We hit one of those loops with 51 people on the team.
Right.
So what happens specifically as it relates to gross profit is, okay, so gross profit corrects a little bit, but we still have, you know, we're not setting up operational budgets. Like, we're just kind of doing it like, oh, we're over this number. Like, yeah, you want that tool? Cool. We'll add it. We'll try it. We trust you. Like, all this stuff that it's not done with bad intentions, but it's done recklessly, even if we realized it or not. So we were doing that. Same thing with our hires. You know, and what happens is when that correction comes, well, then our team member spend goes way up, our operational spend's way up, and what gets pressed down is the profit.
Yes.
You know, and fortunately, we didn't do that to a level where it like flipped the business, right? But that happened to us in 19. We were starting to evaluate that moving into 20. And then we kind of got a double whammy of that in 20 as we got into March. And, you know, COVID hit, you know, because that really intensified for us. So that was good learning moments, but it really was the catalyst for us kind of reaching the next level and being able to evolve and mature as a company. So what came out of that for us is we have a gross profit strategy. We want to spend X amount on team member spend. We want to spend X amount operationally. And we want to have X amount on that percentage number for net income. It doesn't mean we won't make decisions to invest in areas that push us above those limits, but we need to know when we're doing that and have a compelling reason why. Then we need to watch it. We do it on a report card, but we need to watch that to evaluate if we're how good we're executing on that. If we don't execute well on that over a period of time, whether that be 90 days or 6 months, I don't think it's a year. I think it's probably one of the two, depending on the investment. Well, if we're not doing that, then we might need to cut some of the complexity back.
Hmm. Okay, so, fantastic. So what have been the biggest changes or improvements you've made on the building up the operations side of things?
So we figured out how to turn our ops team into a revenue center, you know, okay, where it's not just pulling, you know, from that number, you know, without, and I want to say this, I want to give it full context. You referenced this earlier. The ops teams contribute immensely on the contract side and just with the facilitation of everything that goes on within the staffing company. It's vital, you know, especially if you're in it for the long run. But they don't necessarily drive a sales number up. They don't generate gross profit. They're a part of generation of gross profit, and then that their operational expense, you know, is coming like right out of that. Well, we figured out as we started these other companies, you know, we have shared services. And so we're able to build, like, one of the hardest things for a staffing company to scale is that we're probably better in sales than we are in operations.
Yes.
How do I know that? Because I live this, you know, and, yes, and over a decade, we were able to improve it. But I look at it now, it's like, man, like, if I were to start another recruiting business with, oh, shoot, you know, we started six more. Well, how would I do it? Well, I would love to have a built out team and be able to get a fixed cost point on that and be able to kind of control that cost as we're growing. And let me focus my hiring in on adding good recruiting, you know, people to the team. That's what I'm probably better at as the owner at that point anyways. Mm. Let the experts, you know, do this. So that's what we did. And so we built for that, you know, right within that team. So we did that for a couple of years. It's been an immense success for us. It's helped the other businesses be more profitable. It's helped the acumen of the entrepreneurs grow faster. And as we got good at that, we just decided to take that external too. So we have HR services group that helps externally with clients too. A lot of people that are kind of under a 50 headcount for team members. And then some mid-sized businesses as well that were either doing their full HR support or a lot of times assisting their generalist or like HR directors if they don't have their generalists properly staffed.
That's awesome.
That's all come from that.
So if, let me just make sure I understand this correctly. So you've got this shared service center, which, yep. Did you say that they bill all the other companies in the portfolio?
They do, but we do that at a, like, we can put a robust team on that, and I can put a team that, you know, the outlay of that team's skill set, like, might be $1 million in payroll on an annual basis, and they're getting it for 10 to 15% of that.
Right,
so,
exactly.
And it's not so much about the time associated, it's the expertise and where we need them, and that's, like, we now have four of the companies doing contract side of things, right?
Yeah.
Well, for three of those companies, it would be a tall task. There would be two of them are more technical, but one specifically is doing a lot of industrial staffing, right? So what, now you get into comp, you get into, you know, safety, you know, like, it's not just about the comp, it's about like the safety proactively up front, like what's in place with all this stuff. Well, yeah, it's just of immense value to have that stuff set up to try and keep a mod from getting out of control. That set up is of immense value if you're going to try and go down that path.
Absolutely. And then you've started offering that service externally to clients as well. That's genius. Love it.
Yeah, we're trying to grow that. That's our newest area. Having a lot of success. We're above our targets for the year. But we're hoping to really do what we call them igniters, but cross our igniter this year and then really invest in expanding that, similar to, like, you know, there's some good companies out there from a marketing standpoint, at least. I can't speak to what they do, but like Bambi does a really good job marketing this. Insperity is one that I've seen, you know, quite a bit that I think does a good job at least marketing it. And we're doing a lot of that organically now. The decision hasn't been made. Do we keep doing that from within talent, or do we break that off so that we can market it, like specifically standalone? We're still in the process of deciding that. So,
boy, there's so much to unpack here. And I feel like we've explored some really interesting topics, but I would love to do this again sometime. Cause like, I feel like there's so much more we've scratched the surface of. You, two more quick questions before I let you go. One is, you mentioned, I think you call it, was it recurring revenue, which was distinct from your contract revenue. Could you elaborate on what that means?
So our reoccurrings would be contract. It would be, you know, you're probably familiar with like RPO. Like we like to coin our own terms for everything. And it's still, I'm sitting here with our marketing guy. So it's, from a keyword standpoint, it would be interesting to see if that is actually better for us or worse. But so recruiting partner services for us is similar to RPO. Okay. We think it's like a much more, it has a much more robust capability than just a standard RPO.
Yeah.
But so what we set up there, like anything that we set up on that that's over 6 months, we consider that in our reoccurring revenue column. A lot of those are annual contracts, or even in some instances, 2 or 3 year contracts.
Right.
So that's a big area of our reoccurrings. And then our HR services team, we do, you know, a monthly reoccurring or SOW work that similarly goes 3, 6, 12 months or longer. So anything that we get like that, we tack into our reoccurring flows and are watching that. So
I love that. That's brilliant. Like, we could do a whole session just on that. Final question is, be humble, crave improvement. I like your values. Like, people should definitely go to the website, sparktalentinc.com. So what does be humble, crave improvement mean in your business?
Yeah. You know, to me, I think I just posted on this recently. So
you did. That's how I found out about it.
Yeah. So to me, it's like, when you look at being humble, it's not about being like timid or meek necessarily in something. Like, it's okay to have confidence, right? Like, I think part of being humble is first being good, you know, and then just not that you have to pound your chest all the time about how good you are, that your track record speaks for itself. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's part of it. And then the other part would be, you know, where we love, like where we just added in like crave improvement, right? Well, no matter how good you think you are, there's always someone better. There's always more to learn. And if at any point you feel like that's not the case, you're probably on a collision course with some adversity. So we look at that like, yeah, like, hey, we can be confident in what we do. We can believe in what we do. We want to let our actions and our work speak for itself. We want to enter a room with confidence. We want to believe in ourselves and our capabilities. And at the same time, we want to understand that we can always improve. We can always get better. The more we learn about a topic, the more you realize there is to learn, and that we should just always be pushing to get better.
Beautiful. I think that's a great way to finish up the podcast interview, Aaron. So listen, it's been a real honor speaking to you. Thank you so much for sharing, you know, your wealth of experience, all the, you know, adversity you faced and the success, the triumphs you've had as well. So appreciate you.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, Mark. It's been great talking to you. And I'd love to do it again sometime.